This is Jeff Kober, and we welcome you to this Disney Insights. Like Disney MGM Studios, which we've been celebrating the last month, Pleasure Island at Walt Disney World also opened up 35 years ago. Also, like Disney's Hollywood Studios, it morphed over time. Unlike the studios, however, it's gone, with only a few remnants reminding us of that strangely unusual outside the Disney brand creation. We consider each of the clubs, plus restaurants, stores, and more. We look at how it got started and how it met its demise. And I share my own personal stories of interacting with this unique entertainment offering and its incredibly talented cast, all the while staying sober. So join us as we find insights from Walt Disney World's Pleasure Island. By the way, check out Disney Insights because it's going to offer a lot of visuals, a lot of text, a lot of links, a lot of stuff associated with this podcast. And you're probably going to want to subscribe while you're there because that's a way you can be, you can get the word when new podcasts and posts come out. So be sure to check that out. We also appreciate those of you who've gone to iTunes, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcast to give it a positive rating and, if possible, a review. This really helps the littlest podcast that ever could to extend its reach to others looking for more Disney insights. So let's talk about Disney's Pleasure Island. So Pleasure Island was clearly a part of the Michael Eisner era, a time when Walt Disney World needed to become the biggest attraction in the world. Disney was in competition with places like Las Vegas, Branson, Missouri, an emerging cruise market, and even resorts like Club Med, many of which were looking for more family audiences than adult audiences. Locally as well, Walt Disney World needed to compete against every major attraction and venue in the greater Orlando area, especially Universal Studios, as we've talked about in our previous podcasts about Disney's Hollywood Studios 35th anniversary. Their Universal City Walk was years from being created, but there was another club venue eyeing Disney's attention. Church Street Station had been just that, a train station since 1889, but over time, an entrepreneur by the name of Bosman Snow took over the complex and made it into an entertainment venue similar to one he had done up in Pensacola, Florida. Opening in 1974, an amalgamation of clubs were combined under one price, and for a couple of decades, they were very popular among the locals, especially those who wanted to get away from the whole Disney thing or didn't at least want the hassle of driving all the way down into Disney. Church Street Station was located right downtown Orlando. And so it was much more Church Street Station was located right in the heart of downtown Orlando, or whatever was downtown Orlando in the early 70s, but it was a lot more proximate to people living in the Central Florida area. Well, riding the line between adult clubs and family entertainment, Imagineers built out a club concept that they thought might be a cool place to visit. They called it Pleasure Island, but someone at the top must have given a fit over its alliteration to the film Pinocchio. Eisner even refers to its origination as such. That eventually the Imagineers gave the most uninteresting and unrelated story about this man named Meriwether Pleasure and how the island came to be. Technically, Pleasure Island isn't even an island, as it was simply a ditch built around a parcel of land, somewhat peninsular and like, that, adjoined the lake nearby. Actually, the entire look and feel of the island is largely based on the concept of Vancouver's Granville Island, which took a warehouse district with restaurants, shops, clubs, and theaters and made it a popular place for residents there to visit. And Imagineers probably took the word island from Granville Island when they decided to create Pleasure Island. Imagineers gave the design and concepts a 10-year design life cycle for popularity. That it lasted as long as it did is miraculous and also messy. It always struggled with being on Disney brand. It was far more grown up than Walt Disney World operations ever wanted any of their venues to be. But to keep families somewhat interested, they provided choices for teens wanting a place to hang out as well. The mantra was to get people to stay on property day or night, and this was a big answer to the stay at night problem. Built in time to be part of the larger Disney MGM Studio massive press event opening, work happened quickly to make this attraction open in time. In fact, in an act of resourcefulness, two closed rail cars from the defunct Fort Wilderness Railroad was moved from the campground, re-outfitted, painted, and made into ticket booths, entering the singular entrance. Another would later be formed near the West End stage. The place opened with six clubs, all very unique. Let's look at each and how they evolved in the story of Pleasure Island. The first is the Neon Armadillo. To understand competing against Church Street Station, you have to understand that one of the biggest draws for the locals at that complex was the Cheyenne Saloon. It was a great place to club downtown with cowboy boots, and it drew many acts that ultimately became successful, like Alan Jackson and Garth Brooks. So it made sense to Disney to have a distinct club like Neon Armadillo. Eventually, it would move to another larger location by taking over the fireworks factory on the other side of the island. Here it would be named the Wild Horse Saloon, and the Bet, Black Entertainment Television soundstage, would take over the former Neon Armadillo. Towards the end, the Wild Horse itself became a top 40s dance club called Motion, and that was the end of the line dance for country music offerings at Walt Disney World. Videopolis East was another offering that evolved. Of course, Disney had to acknowledge that while Pleasure Island was not intended as a family place, there should be something for young adults or teenagers. The perfect answer for this was Videopolis East, a much smaller version of Videopolis that was created for Disneyland in California. Established in 1985, it was a hotspot for young people looking to go somewhere on weekends. Its roots began with date night at Disneyland at the Carnation Gardens and then evolved in the later 1960s to the Tomorrowland Terrace with its stage that moved the band from below up to the crowds on the dance floor. So Videopolis was welcomed as the next big thing to come in terms of a place for kids to rock out at Disneyland. But that offering under the same name did not stick the landing in Pleasure Island. No one knew anything about what Videopolis was, and what it was at Pleasure Island was a fraction of the huge event stage extravaganza at Disneyland. Videopolis East was not only poorly received, but it was off-brand to what Pleasure Island was supposed to be for adults. Partly because of this mix of teenage and adult offerings, Pleasure Island was trying to ride the line of having something to offer to young adults. But all that served to splinter the offering and lose any kind of synergistic appeal. All this was spoken of by Michael Eisner in his biography, Work in Progress. Let me just share with you a portion from that book. He speaks of Pleasure Island, the nighttime entertainment extravaganza, being opened in 1989, the same time as the Disney MGM Studios. Quote, "On paper, it seemed like a terrific way to provide another amenity and build a whole new business. From the time Frank and I first began visiting Walt Disney World, it had gnawed at me that there was virtually nothing to do at night. What happened, I always wondered, to those visitors who weren't satisfied to watch TV after dinner and go to sleep early. After several false starts, our team came up with the idea for a complex of restaurants and clubs, everything from comedy to dance to rock and roll to country and western, to be located on a small island adjacent to the Disney Village shopping area. We took the name Pleasure Island from Pinocchio, end of quote. Just again, reminding that I think the Pinocchio name was how Pinocchio was the origination of this name, even though they used Meriwether Pleasure as the real story, so to speak. He continues, quote, "The first problem was that we went over budget and spent too much on the facility." Let me just interject again in this. This is a bunch of warehouses, so the budget must not have been really impressive. He goes on to say, "Beyond that, our theme park operators had never before tried to create entertainment for more sophisticated young adult audiences. Pleasure Island lacked the kind of excitement or edge. After months of hectoring park executives about the problem, I decided to send Art Levitt down to Orlando." Art Levitt, by the way, was an assistant to Michael Eisner during this time. Art lacked any operating experience, but he had the credentials that Frank and I considered most important. He was single, 30 years old, and actually enjoyed going out at night. We decided to take a chance on him, not least because neither of us knew anyone young and single who might run this business. He quotes, "If I'm not hearing from our park guys that I want to fire you," I told Art, "then you're not screaming loud enough." Art had terrific promotional instincts and a willingness to take risks. He quickly added street games and outdoor entertainment to Pleasure Island and instituted a New Year's Eve celebration every night. He arranged to have the comedian Howie Mandel arrive one evening on a horse and ride through the complex. He brought well-known rock musicians in to play at the clubs and spin records to guest DJs. To create a sense of glamour and excitement, he hired drivers to park their white stretch limousines out front, ostensibly waiting for guests they drop off. He even hired local models to come out and hang out at Pleasure Island until it became hip enough as a destination that it was no longer necessary to pack the house. When Art pushed too far for Disney, hiring dancers that were just a bit too scantily clad, for example, we reined him in. I always found it easier to pull back on an overly enthusiastic executive than to inspire a passive one to take action. Most of Art's ideas were on the mark. As the crowds at the clubs grew, we moved forward on the idea that that had first been raised several years earlier, in closing the attractions and charging a single nightly admission the way we already did at our other parks. By the time Art moved on in 1993, Pleasure Island was making a solid profit. By the way, I should talk about the fact that Art Levitt eventually became CEO of Hard Rock Cafe, which will play into our story a little bit later. At any rate, from this new adult venue, Videopolis East just wasn't in harmony. And so it was taken out. In fact, anything involving young people or teenagers was taken out. And this club was then called Cage. It was more a cacophony of steel. A much better concept came along in time called 8-Tracks, which perfectly targeted guests who grew up listening to such. It became a better example of who the brand was really trying to market. Other changes came at this time, one of them being the Funmeister, who played an important role in marketing the concept of fun at Pleasure Island. It had a similar look to Mac Tonight, a fictional Crescent Moon character McDonald's was using. Funmeister was part of the marketing to get people to turn out. It too had a 90s look to it, full of teal, hot pink, golden yellow, and royal blue, much like the facility itself. When Funmeister went away, as it did toward the end of Pleasure Island's run, well, it was never really quite the same. Part of what did work was an annual pass that could be had for about 3 visits or roughly $37. This served especially to bring in the local audience, and that helped boost attendance in a major way, especially at Mannequins. If anything brought in the local audience, it was Mannequins Dance Palace. But the local audience wasn't Orlando residents per se, it was Disney cast members. This club resonated well with young cast members, especially college program cast members, and particularly the LGBTQIA or gay community, as it was largely referred to at the time, if referred to at all. If you weren't aware, among cast members, the word Epcot stood for Every Paycheck Comes on Thursday. So Thursday nights and into the weekend were always strong at Pleasure Island, but especially Thursday night. Many a cast member would wake up on Friday mornings, realizing they didn't have anything in spending money until the following Thursday payday. Mannequins was uniquely designed in terms of layout. You entered via an elevator. The elevator took you to the top third floor, where you would then work your way back down to the bottom, where a large revolving floor would rotate. This did a terrific job of dispersing the flow of guests throughout the building and not just bunching everyone right at the entrance or exit. It was named Mannequins for the large number of such figures throughout the building, all wearing some strange costume or attire tied to dance itself in some way. You could find recreations of Shall We Dance moment from The King and I to costumes from the musical Cats. But the real show of Mannequins was much more lively. The Pleasure Island Explosion Dancers put the 90s into the 90s. Their look and choreography spoke to that decade better than any. And they were probably the most talented, hardest working dance ensemble on property, backed up by a state-of-the-art sound system and a lighting package behind its stage that was so intense, it was known by many as the toaster oven. It had its own programmed light shows each night. Mannequins had no difficulty creating the most intense party experience, but the job was to get all of Pleasure Island moving to the beat. So when they weren't dancing at Mannequins, the Pleasure Island Explosion Dancers could be found gyrating between band acts and the DJ on the West End stage. But still, this wasn't enough. Under new management's direction, as Eisner spoke of in his book, Pleasure Island started doing New Year's Eve nightly, with both the band and the dancers and the DJ together creating one moment on the West End stage. Just add a dozen skylights, a burst of fireworks and some confetti, actually dumpster loads of confetti, and you had people staying through the night rather than checking out a club or two for an hour and going home. This was the equivalent of fireworks at the parks. It kept people spending and having a good time. And as long as they were spending, Pleasure Island would last. It became a signature piece that kept Pleasure Island feeling like it was the hottest club in town. Now, the next club was the Zephyr Rock and Rollerdrome. When it originally opened, it started as a place that combined roller skating and dancing to pop hits. Now add liquor. Oh, and did we mention minors? It was an attorney's nightmare made in Xanadu. Partly because the Roller Rink Disco Emporium concept or theme included the idea that Meriwether was excited about outer space and possible aliens. So he built experimental aircraft and beamed out messages to intelligent life forms wherever they could be found. Now those same spacecraft inventions were vehicles for DJs to host a party. It was all weird. And frankly, it lasted no more than a year. It was shuttered in 1990 and became simply the Beach Club. But just like Mannequins, it was a popular and one of the biggest hangouts for those looking for a place to drink and dance. The next club is the Comedy Warehouse. No neighborhood of clubs would be complete without a comedy club. A nightclub that featured an improv comedy troupe. This was born out of a comedy improv movement that was known in Orlando as the Sack Theater. This group was so popular that Disney approached them to provide entertainment when Epcot opened for Italy, UK, and around Future World. Craig McNair Wilson was the artistic director of this, and according to an article by my beloved friend Jim Corcus, who, while he was working at Disney, was known as Wade Sampson, Wilson himself coined the term streetmosphere. He was the same individual creating the Citizens of Hollywood that were so beloved at the Disney MGM studios. It was he, Chris Carradine, architect, and Joe Rohde, that we all know as an Imagineer who built Disney's Animal Kingdom, that built out the Merriweather Pleasure story that answered to why these warehouse buildings were there in the first place. There were many concepts Wilson was involved in, but key to the improv group's success was the Comedy Warehouse. The Comedy Warehouse originally featured a parody show called Forbidden Disney. This was, frankly, very, very funny. And it was tied in with Disney props around the warehouse, some bizarre that could be found throughout. After a few seasons, it became more of a comedy improv format. Think of this as something akin to Whose Line Is It Anyway? That show included Wayne Brady, who was actually part of the original Sack Theater group. The reason for an improv format was that the club played to a largely repeat audience, which became the same problem with the Adventurers Club. All this improv helped to keep the show fresh, and you were always waiting in line for the next show, if not the one after that. At the same time all this was going on, I personally had just moved to Orlando and was director of operations at Water Mania. It was a small water park down 192, not much larger in size than Pleasure Island itself. Among my many duties, aquatics, rentals, food and beverage, retail admission, and others, I was responsible for entertainment. The water park had a big DJ booth overlooking the big wave pool, and it had a DJ who had made a big name for himself in the community. So big that Disney gave him a big offer to work with all their DJ gigs, largely big ballroom events. I needed someone to fill that gap, and my inspiration came from Pleasure Island. I thought if we could combine improv with the Beach Club theme, we could create something I refer to as Water Maniacs, a DJ group composed of Sack Comedy Theater recruits who were taught how to be DJs. My thinking was you could train comedy improv folks to become a DJ, but you couldn't get a DJ to master comedy improv. So I reached out to Sack, and they sent over a group of possible hires that I auditioned. I ended up selecting 7 or 8, as I recall, as I needed to not only staff the DJ booth at the wave pool 7 days a week, but run a secondary and temporary DJ booth at the Wipeout, which was Orlando's first, an exclusive automatic surfing machine that was based on Flow Rider technology. The one at Typhoon Lagoon opening up this time is actually just, it's like 7 toilets that flush at the same time. This was a very different kind of technology, and it was wildly popular among teens, and I wanted to have a DJ there as well. So I went out and I sought DJs out at the Beach Club at Pleasure Island. I told them my vision of having them create the right playlist for the park, the right equipment to play it on, and the training to teach the Maniacs or the Sack Theater folks how to be DJs. In addition to pay, the Beach Club DJs each got free Water Mania passes for them and their girlfriends. We ran the concept all through the summer with the Maniacs, not only playing the best hits, but running around the park doing contests and games and, of course, working the crowd with their comedy improv. What the main acts loved about the gig was that they could work daytime shifts and then go and do their nighttime shows. What they hated was hauling equipment to and from and having to work in intense heat. The concept didn't last more than the summer. However, one of my funniest stories is taking my wife to Pleasure Island for the first time when she moved there. I'd already gotten to know the DJs. I'd already set things up. And I wanted them to actually meet up with the DJ. So we went to the beach club, and I could see the DJs up in the booth working, and they knew I was there. And we were just kind of dancing, enjoying the time, when all of a sudden, from behind came this blonde. And I have to say, she was an amazingly beautiful blonde. And she started to flirt with me. And I did not, I mean, I'm just not the guy anybody would want to flirt with. But anyway, my wife is looking at this whole thing going on with this woman making over me. And I was like, what is going on here? And then I look up into the booth and the DJs were just dying with laughter. It turned out that it was one of their girlfriends who was always coming with them to Watermania, knew me and was actually playing a game on me, but it was one of my more memorable experiences of working with the DJs. They were great professionals, and so were the SAC improv players. They worked a hard gig that summer at Watermania, but they were great, and it created a great experience over at Watermania. Another comedy improv act found another home at Pleasure Island. It was known as the Adventurers Club. The Adventurers Club was a happy accident of an idea that was born of separate concepts, to include the romance of Rick's Cafe at Casablanca, Tamara, a live theatrical multi-room play in Los Angeles that Imagineers had seen and participated in, as well as a backyard event Joe Rohde would hold, which was known as the Last Days of Raj. This concept of an adventurers club evolved a little at first. Birnbaum, in his 1988 summary the year before, spoke of this club that was going to be a place of gypsies and ghosts, where a certain Miss Zenobia tells tales and fortunes to those at the Illusions Bar. Masks and shrunken heads festoon the walls. An organ plays by itself in the library saloon. Well, in truth, much of this exists, but it was more about merry and mirth than foreboding. Joe Rohde brought in the eclectic look and feel of the club that is signature and that people have been trying to imitate to this day. Roger Cox was the director and writer for the Adventurers Club, and Wilson, along with others, were brought in at night to figure out how the cast-audience interaction could work for guests who have since loved it since it opened 35 years ago. This was the thing that made the Adventurers Club succeed so well. It was its cast of characters, names and characters, and people like Hathaway Brown, Fletcher Hodges, Otis T. Wren, Madame Zarkoff, Pamelia Birkins, and Samantha Sterling. Oh, I love you, Samantha. Were loved and embraced by visitors as if they were their own strange family members. The improv that occurred was the best of the best, and guests returned again and again as if it were, again, a family reunion nightly. But its popularity was also part of its problem. Like the Comedy Warehouse, regulars or annual pass holders would keep coming night after night. They tended to buy less booze, and in the case of Adventurers Club, they just stuck around all evening, again, spending less, and inevitably the real revenue of the place dried up, figuratively and literally. I was with the Disney Institute, and in the late 90s, tried to figure out how to utilize the Adventurers Club space, which I loved its decor. But I wanted to figure out how to utilize the space for groups during the day before it was put into show mode at night. I moved back and forth between the onstage spaces and the tight backstage quarters. The reason the whole area, known as Hill Street, slopes upwards toward this end of the island is that there are actually dressing rooms that ran underneath the street between Adventurers Club and Comedy Warehouse. It did much to creating a collegial group among its cast, and in its own right, was an intriguing world in and of itself. But the whole place, the whole Adventurers Club at daytime, it just reeked of spilled booze. And without the players and the show going on, it was not conducive to bringing guests in, much less business executives wanting to know how to make the business behind the magic work. Still, this is the most remembered attraction above and beyond everything at Pleasure Island. It was even the one part of the Meriwether Pleasure story that worked in that he established the Adventurers Club, which ultimately led him to have a chapter group that was part of the Society of Explorers and Adventurers, C. Curiously, this theme has gone on longer than the entire Pleasure Island concept itself, with references played out nearby at Magic Kingdom and Skipper's Canteen and in faraway places like Tokyo Disney Sea, with the Fortress Explorations and Tower of Terror, as well as Hong Kong Disneyland with Mystic Manor. People love the Society of Explorers Adventurers, or SEA as the acronym is known for, and they seek out this whole thing wherever they go. And it all began with the Adventurers Club. By the way, the idea of doing a restaurant as part of the Adventurers Club was batted around forever. Its previous location is now the previous location of the Adventurers Club is now where the Edison resides. But other restaurant concepts were part of this place called Pleasure Island. Let's look at those for a moment. The first of these restaurant concepts is the Fireworks Factory. This Levy restaurant was built on the idea of a factory whose operation was just that, fireworks. Even props in the restaurant were on loan from the Guccis, a famous fireworks family in New York. That theming was tied even into Typhoon Lagoon, where a firework explosion scattered dynamite throughout the community. Look for this when you're in the queue of the original family water slides. Undetonated explosives can be seen as far away as here in Mount Tilly at Typhoon Lagoon. In the end, this restaurant was replaced by the Wild Horse Saloon, which would at the very end be replaced by another club called Motion. Speaking of Typhoon Lagoon, did you ever consider the contrast of this locale based on a typhoon to that of Pleasure Island, where a man in charge is named Meriwether? I get it, Merry as in Merry Christmas, weather as in, well, climate. His demise was actually due to not a typhoon, but to Hurricane Charlotte, which few people know. In fact, well, frankly, few people know the origins of the Pleasure Island story anyway. The Portobello Yacht Club was originally intended, according to Wilson, to be a TGI Fridays. Instead, it has taken a decades-old Mediterranean-style look and taste. It's had a couple of refurbishments, but it's now known simply as Portobello's, and it's operated by Levy Restaurants as well. It had a problem in that it was not part of the gated island community of Pleasure Island, but it was part of its offering. That may have been a blessing to Portobello, and perhaps the reason why it still exists today. You didn't need to get a ticket to get into it to dine. It probably also maybe explains the demise of the Fireworks Factory, which was inside Pleasure Island's gates. How about the Empress Lily? That was still in her original glory when Pleasure Island opened and served as a listed formal dining experience as part of Pleasure Island, even though this ship, which technically is a building sitting on water, was not even inside the island per se. Over time, it has gone through changes since 1996 of becoming Fulton's Crab House and then later to becoming Paddlefish. It too is operated by the Levy Restaurant family as well. But in its earliest day, it was the place to find jazz. So as the restaurant experience evolved and the jazz location went away at the Empress Lily, jazz found a home by taking over the former Meriwether's Market. Merriweather's Market was a counter service answer to Pleasure Island, because anything with the Disney name behind it, well, you got to have a counter service place somewhere. It was poorly received and was replaced by the Pleasure Island Jazz Company, which put a jazz club within the confines of the island itself. Still, it would be replaced by the Raglan Road Irish Pub, which stands in its place today. AMC Pleasure Island didn't do much more than food and sodas when it first opened, but it moved next door further in 1990, pushing the entire property or this entire area further west. It was the first of what would become Disney West Side. It opened with 10 theaters, but by the time Disney's West Side opened, it expanded to 24 theaters. It has the distinction of hosting one of the premieres for Dick Tracy. For many, this was the nicest theater in this part of Orlando. There weren't a lot of other great choices in the area. Planet Hollywood, well, early on before Pleasure Island came to be, the Hard Rock approached Disney about putting in Hard Rock, a Hard Rock restaurant. Disney thought they could do it alone. They didn't need Hard Rock, and they turned them down. Hard Rock went to Universal Orlando and ultimately created a guitar-shaped restaurant when the park first opened. It would be replaced by another in City Walk and a hotel where the original restaurant stood. If you remember, the original restaurant was, you could only sense it was a guitar from the air, which meant it meant nothing because nobody could see it from the air. But anyway, the length of the guitar, the top portion of the guitar was a bridge that crossed over into Universal Studios and entered where the Curious George, now the new DreamWorks Playground, is currently. Back then, it was near where the Psycho House stood on the hill. But anyway, that's how you got into Hard Rock Cafe. Again, that's now a hotel, and then a new Hard Rock stands where City Walk is. So Disney, realizing their mistake, they went to a comparable, popular venue of that same era known as Planet Hollywood. It was a hot property back then, made famous by its co-owners, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, Bruce Willis, and Demi Moore. The weekend the three-tiered globe was dedicated was a big ticket to get into, and for years, it was one of the most difficult restaurants to get into, despite its burgeoning three floors of movie-related props and dining experiences. A gator stood on top of a nearby kiosk, making it a popular place for t-shirts and other retail that you could easily access. There are only four restaurants today, but a comparable number of resorts in the Planet Hollywood universe. Yet the signature restaurant still stands in Disney Springs, having been remodeled in 2017. Its global shape is still provocative, even if the gator and its souvenir booth is no longer around. Shops? Well, Pleasure Island had some one-off shops that were pretty interesting. The one honoring Who Framed Roger Rabbit's famed femme fatale was Jessica's, which included a huge, two-sided, 30-foot neon sign complete with a swinging leg. It would be moved to the Disney West End stage after the shop closed. Avigator Supply sold Adventurers Club and Disney Indiana Jones-style merchandise. This would be replaced by Paradiso 37 in time. And for those looking for unique real movie finds, they checked out the real finds for increasingly popular Hollywood-style memorabilia. The problem with all these elements, like Planet Hollywood and AMC Pleasure Island, is that you had to walk through a dead Pleasure Island to get to them during the day. The place stunk, was nothing more than hot colored concrete in the sun, and was on an incline, making it difficult for many to walk up and down. In the end, four things primarily killed off Pleasure Island. First, an evolution or of a generation of people who grew up and out of Pleasure Island. The next generation didn't see Pleasure Island as being necessarily the place to be seen and heard. Second, added to this was the evolution of the entire Disney property. In the mid-1990s, the Universal Hollywood Park out in California opened up an adjacent place known as City Walk. It was hugely popular, and Disney wanted to replicate that in some form. That form became known as Downtown Disney West Side, which included several restaurants like Gloria Estefan's Bongos and Wolfgang Puck's, plus an expanded AMC movie theater complex, a Virgin record store, a Disney Quest arcade experience, and a Cirque du Soleil theater. People loved this new area, and the whole of it would be retitled as Downtown Disney. Third, the complication came then from people who wanted to get from Downtown Disney Village Marketplace over to Downtown Disney West Side. Because you had to have a ticket to walk through Pleasure Island, the only way to get over there at night was waiting for a boat or going into the parking lot and taking a sidewalk to get from one side to the other. This really made the entire experience arduous. Disney sought to correct that by opening up the space at night towards the end of its run and making the clubs only require the admission, but that took the party out of Pleasure Island, and it just wasn't New Year's Eve every night anymore. Finally, and fourth, not only did Disney want to replicate the Universal Hollywood City Walk, but so did Universal Orlando. And the advent of that big complex not only made for huge competition, but also made it for residents in Orlando to get in and out of much easier. It would not only impact Disney's own attendance, it also added to the ultimate demise of the Church Street Station. All this came to an end at Pleasure Island in 2008. The dead end of the property was torn down with the intent that it would become Hyperion Wharf. But management change and new vision was placed on the table that would allow the entire retail operation to be reconfigured under the title of Disney Springs. It is now largely the area known as The Landing at Disney Springs. It is a more fluid pedestrian space and blends in with the entire retail dining entertainment location. Pleasure Island was never my favorite place, but still, Pleasure Island was unique of the Disney offerings, and a lot of people have tremendous fond experiences of spending time in the clubs there at Pleasure Island, especially the Avengers Club. The Adventures Club. I hope I didn't say that several times in this show. Well, that wraps this up, doesn't it? We thank you for joining us for this podcast. And a couple of things I want to note for you. You need to check out some of my books, including A Century of Powerful Disney Insights on Amazon. It's a great way to celebrate the Walt Disney Company. It goes through the first 50 years of Disney, beginning with Walt and Roy. Check it out, along with other books such as Disney Leadership in You and The Wonderful World of Customer Service at Disney. I would also recommend, for those of you who want more of this kind of insight, Disney insight, join the Wayfinder group. That's our Patreon group, and it's where we bring the best details of Disney, both in terms of the magic of the parks as well as the business behind the magic. Depending on the tier you buy into, this Patreon group gives you access to Disney at Play interactive guides and also to a wealth of stuff that deals with best in business Disney practices. So you want to probably check out the Wayfinder Society, and there's a link in our show notes and on DisneyInsights.com. Finally, if you want to create more excellence in your organization, if you want to learn these kinds of lessons for yourself about brand, about taking care of your guests, about building creativity and innovation, check out our website, Performance Journeys, which hosts this show. And if you're looking for a keynote speaker, you need some consulting, need workshops, seminars, or online and other resources, come to us at Performance Journeys, where we can help you take your business to the next level. Thanks again for joining us for this Disney at Play podcast. Make sure you check out some of the previous podcasts, two big ones we had this last week, this last couple of weeks, dealing with Tokyo Disney's new offerings and the announcements at Paris, plus things that have been happening with the anniversary of Disney's Hollywood Studios. Check them all out. Again, thanks for being part of the magic here. And in the words of Sinbad's storybook voyage, always follow the compass of your heart. Have a great day. We'll see you real soon.